Claire's experiences in forensics had prompted several theories to consider. It had obviously been planned that the blows had been struck with the rolled-up carpet. Stockton presumably would have had carpet fibers in his head wound when he hit the floor. And if the carpet on the floor were the same carpet as the remnant in the attic, then the police would just assume that the fibers became embedded in his head wound when he hit the floor. They would not suspect that someone had slugged him with a rolled-up remnant in the attic. After all the complaints of abuse against the man, everyone, including the police, had probably been grateful he was finally dead. Finished with the stepfather, Claire moved on to the mother. Webb had said Charlotte London had placed the pile of clothes there. Had she also supplied the rolled-up carpet? Had she coached her tall, strong teenage son on how to do away with the abusive husband? Was that how the woman had decided to handle it? And then stepped in to finish the job, leaving Webb to later pick up the pieces, allowing him to repress guilt so deep he couldn't even remember the event except under hypnosis? But such an extraordinary repressed memory would taint every aspect of his being and of his future. It would manifest itself in many ways, none of them positive. Claire could now clearly understand why Webb was like he was. He had become a lawman not to make up for Harry Sullivan's felonious ways, but because of his own guilt. A boy helping to kill his stepfather at the instruction of his natural mother. From a mental health perspective, it didn't get more screwed up than that. Claire looked over at Webb, who just sat there so peacefully with his eyes closed, awaiting her next instruction. She also now understood his somnambulism. Children from homes of terrible abuse often withdrew into fantasy worlds as protection from the horrors of reality. Such children created imaginary friends to combat loneliness, and also invented wonderful lives and adventures to ward off feelings of insecurity and depression. Claire had treated somnambules who could control their higher brain functions to such an extent that they could either embellish or completely wipe out whole sections of their memories, just as Webb had done. Though a dynamic, independent, self-reliant sort on the outside, Webb London, she concluded, was obedient and relied upon others on the inside. Hence his dependence on his HRT team and his exceptional ability to carry out orders. He was eager to please, to be accepted. She shook her head. The man was a mess inside. And yet he had withstood the psychological battering of both the Bureau and HRT. Webb had said he had figured out the MMPI test and had managed to lie his way right through it. He did not know how right he was about that. She looked at Romano as something new occurred to her. She would have to craft the question delicately because she couldn't reveal any patient confidences. Webb had told her previously that he wasn't taking any medications, and she had accepted his word on that. With what she had just learned, though, she wondered if he were taking something that would help combat the internal traumas that were clearly eating away at him. She motioned Romano over to a far corner, out of Webb's hearing. "Do you know anything about any medications Webb might be taking?" "Did Webb say he was taking any pills?" "I was just wondering. It's sort of standard operating procedure for shrinks to ask," she answered evasively. "Lots of people take pills to help them sleep," Romano said defensively. She hadn't said they were sleeping pills, so Romano did know about them, thought Claire. "I'm not saying it's wrong. I was just wondering if he ever mentioned to you if he took anything, and if so, what he took." "You think he might be addicted, is that it? Well, I'm telling you, you're nuts." "I'm not implying that at all. It's just important that I know in case I want to prescribe something for him. I don't want any dangerous drug interactions." Romano still was not buying it.
"So why don't you ask him?"
"Well, I'm sure you're well aware that people don't always tell their doctors the truth, particularly the kind of doctor I am. I just want to make sure there are no problems." Romano looked over at Webb, apparently to make sure he was still out. He looked back at Claire and seemed to be having trouble getting the words out.
I saw him holding what looked like a prescription bottle the other day. But look, he's hurting right now, and he's probably a little screwed up about things and maybe needs a little help pill-wise. But the Bureau's real stiff on that crap. They throw you overboard and let you sink or swim on your own. Well, guys have to look out for each other then.
Romano stopped, looked over at Webb, and said a little wistfully,
"He's the best HRT's ever had."
"You know he thinks very highly of you, too."
"I guess I did know."
Romano left the room. Claire went to the window and watched as he crossed the road and was soon out of sight. It would have been very hard for him to reveal a confidence like that about his friend, and he probably felt himself a traitor for doing it. But in the end, it would help Webb far more than hurt him. She sat across from Webb, leaned forward, and spoke slowly so that he wouldn't miss a word. Ordinarily, hypnosis was used to pare away the inhibitions and layers covering repressed memories that prevented patients from really talking about their troubles. Typically, the patient was brought out of hypnosis fully remembering everything that had happened while he was under. Here, Claire could not do that. It would be too traumatic. Instead, she gave Webb a post-hypnotic suggestion. It instructed him that when he came out of the hypnotic state, he would remember only enough to allow him to deal adequately with the situation. What would control what, if anything, he remembered would be his unconscious. Under the circumstances, Claire felt certain he would remember almost nothing. He was not prepared to deal with this, so buried was it within his unconscious. She slowly brought him up the escalator, step by step. Before he came fully out of it, she finished composing herself, prepared herself to face him. When he finally opened his eyes, he looked around the room and then at her. He smiled.
"Anything good?"
"First, I need to ask you a question, Webb." She paused to collect herself again before saying, "Are you taking any medication?" His eyes narrowed.
"Didn't you already ask me that?"
"I'm asking you now."
"Why?"
"You mentioned voodoo as an explanation for why you froze. Let me offer another one, negative drug interaction."
"I wasn't taking any medication before we went into that alley, Claire. I would never do that."
"Drug interactions are funny," replied Claire. "Depending on what you're taking, the effects can materialize sometime after you've stopped taking them." She paused once again and added, "It's important for you to be entirely truthful on this point, Webb. It really is if you want to get to the truth." They stared at each other for a long moment, and then Webb rose and went into his bathroom. A minute later, he came back and handed her a small vial with pills in it. He sat back down as she examined the contents.
"Since you have them with you, should I assume you've been taking them recently?"
"I'm on a job, Claire. No pills. So I deal with the insomnia and the pain you sometimes get with two big holes in you and half a face."
"So why do you have them?"
"Security blanket. You're a psychiatrist. You understand that and thumb-sucking, don't you?"
Claire took out the pills and examined them one by one. They were all different. Most she recognized, some she didn't. She held up one of the pills.
"Do you know where you got this?"
"Why?" he asked suspiciously. "Is there something wrong with it?"
"Perhaps." "Did you get these pills from O'Bannon?" she said doubtfully.
"It's possible, I guess. Although I thought I finished his prescription a long time ago."
"Well, if not O'Bannon, who then?"
Webb became defensive.
"Look, I had to get off the painkillers they were giving me for my injuries because I was growing dependent on them. And then I couldn't sleep for like a year. Some HRT guys have the same problem,
It's not like we're doing illegal drugs or crap like that, but you can only go so long without sleep, even at HRT. Some of the guys have given me pills over the years. I just collect them in a bottle and take them when I need them. That pill might have come from one of them. What's the big deal?
I'm not blaming you for taking medication to help you sleep, Webb. But it's stupid and dangerous for you to take an oddball assortment of pills, even from friends, when you have no idea what drug interactions might occur from their use. You're very lucky something serious hasn't happened to you. And maybe it did, in the alley. Maybe this odd method of pill-taking is the reason you froze.
Claire was also thinking that the traumatic events surrounding Raymond Stockton's death might have bubbled to the surface at the worst possible time, when Webb was in that alley. Perhaps, as she had thought earlier, seeing Kevin Westbrook had triggered something in Webb, disabling him. Webb covered his face with his hands.
Shit. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I can't say for sure that's the case, Webb. She looked at him sympathetically, but there was something else she needed to know. Have you reported the medication you've been taking to your supervisor?
He uncovered his face but didn't look at her.
Okay, she said slowly. Are you going to say anything?
Are you still taking them?
No. As best I can recall, the last time I took one prior to the mission in the alley was a week before. That's it.
Then I have nothing to report.
She held up the same pill again.
I don't recognize this medication, and as a psychiatrist, I've seen just about all of them. I'd like to get it analyzed.
It'll be on the QT, she quickly added, as he looked alarmed.
I have a friend. Your name will never come up.
Do you really think it was the pills, Claire?
She stared at the pill before pocketing the vial and looking back at him.
Webb, I'm afraid we'll never know for certain.
So was the hypnosis a bust? Webb asked finally,
though Claire could tell his mind was clearly on the pills and their possible implication in what had happened to Charlie Team.
No, it wasn't. I learned a lot.
Like what?
Like Harry Sullivan was arrested during your sixth-year birthday party? Do you remember talking about that?
She was reasonably certain he might recall that from the hypnosis session, but not the event with Stockton.
Webb slowly nodded.
Actually, I do. Some of it, anyway.
For what it's worth, before the arrest, you and Harry were having a great time. He clearly loved you very much.
That's good to know, Webb said without enthusiasm.
Often situations that are traumatic are repressed, Webb, sort of a safety valve. Your psyche can't handle it, that level of confrontation, and you basically bury it so you don't need to face it.
But that's like burying toxic waste, he said in a low voice.
That's right, and it sometimes seeps out and does considerable damage.
Anything else? He asked.
Do you recall anything else?
He shook his head. Claire looked away for a moment. Webb, she knew, was in no shape to hear the truth about his stepfather's death. She looked back at him and managed a tiny smile.
Well, I think that's enough.
She looked at her watch.
And I need to get back.
So my dad and me were really getting along.
You were singing songs. He was carrying you on his shoulders. Yes, you were having a great time.
It's starting to come back to me. So there's still hope for me, right?
Webb smiled, perhaps to show he was partly kidding.
There's always hope, Webb, Claire replied.
Chapter 39. Sonny Venables was off duty and out of uniform as he sat in an unmarked car and surveyed the area. There was stirring in the back seat as the big man who was lying on the floorboard stretched out his long legs.
"Don't get antsy, Randy," said Venables. We got some time to go yet.
Trust me, I've waited dudes out a lot longer than this, and from places a lot shittier than the back seat of a car.
Venables nudged out a cigarette from the pack in his pocket, lit it, cracked his window, and blew smoke out.
So you were telling me about your meeting with London.
I covered his backside, even though he didn't know it at the time. Good thing, too, though I don't think Westbrook would have really killed him.
I heard about that guy, but I've never run into him.
Lucky you, but let me tell you, there's a lot worse than him out there. At least Westbrook's got a little code of honor. Most dudes out there just flat-out nuts. Kill you just to kill you and brag about it. Westbrook does everything for a real good reason.
Like maybe take out HRT.
Don't think so. But he delivered a message to London about the tunnels under the building that was HRT's target. That's apparently how the guns came in. London checked it out with Bates, and I heard that he was right.
From what you've told me about Westbrook, he doesn't sound like a message boy.
He is if the person he delivered the message for has somebody he cares about, like his son.
Gotcha. So that person was behind what happened to HRT.
That's my thinking.
So where's the oxy come into all this?
That's the op I saw in the building that night. They even had some of the product there. No coke bricks, just bags of pills. And I saw computerized records that laid it all out. Millions of bucks in business. And in 2 days, it was cleared out.
Why all that trouble to set you up? Why wipe out HRT? That just brings the Bureau down on them like a ton of bricks.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, Cove agreed. But that seems to be what happened.
Venable stiffened and flicked his cigarette out the window.
Showtime, Randy.
Venables watched as a man left the building they'd been watching, walked along the street, turned right, and headed down an alley. Venables started the car and it moved slowly forward.
Is it the guy you were expecting?
Asked Cove.
Yep. You want some info on new drugs coming to town, this boy will know it. Name's Tyrone Walker, but he goes by T. Real imaginative. Belonged to 3 or 4 different crews over the years. Time in jail, time in the hospital, time in drug rehab. He's about 26 and looks 10 years older than me, and I don't look all that good for my age.
Funny I never ran across T before.
Hey, you don't have a monopoly on information in this town. I might just be a lowly street cop, but I get around.
Good thing, Sonny, because I'm tainted goods right now. Nobody will talk to me.
Well, old T will, with the right persuasion.
Venables pulled around the corner, hit the gas, then turned right onto a street that ran parallel to the one where they had been parked. As soon as they turned the corner, T emerged from the alley, which cut through to this street. Venables looked around.
Coast looks clear. You want to do your thing?
Cove was already out of the car. Before he knew what was happening, T had been searched expertly and was lying face down in the back seat of Venables' car, with one of Cove's big hands on the back of his neck, keeping him there. Venables drove off while T loudly cursed them. By the time he calmed, they were 2 miles away and in a better part of town. Cove pulled T to a sitting position. The man looked first at Cove and then at Venables.
Hey, T, said Venables. You looking good. Been taking care of yourself?
Cove could sense T was about to make a lunge out the other door, so he clamped his arm around T's shoulders.
Hey, we just want to talk to you, T. Just talk.
What if I don't want to talk?
Then you can just get out of the car, said Cove.
Is that right? Okay, stop the car and I'm getting out.
Whoa there, T. He didn't say anything about me stopping the car before you got out.
Venables cut the wheel, entered an on-ramp, and they pulled onto Interstate 395, crossed the 14th Street Bridge, and they were in Virginia. Venables pushed the accelerator to 60. T stared out the window at the traffic streaming by and then sat back, his arms folded across his chest.
"Now, my friend here," began Venables. "Your damn friend got a name?"
Cove tightened his grip on T's shoulders.
"Yeah, I got a name. You call me T-Rex. Tell him why, sonny."
"'Cause he eats little T's for breakfast, lunch, and dinner," said Sonny.
"And I just want some information about some new product in town. Crews buying it up and stuff like that. No problems. Just a couple of names and we let you off right where we picked you up."
"And trust me, T, you don't want to piss this man off," added Venables.
"You cops, you ain't doing nothing to me unless you want to get your ass sued off."
Cove stared at the man for a moment and then said,
"Right now, T, you better be real nice to me. I'm not feeling good about things, and I don't give a shit if somebody sues me or not."
"Fuck off!"
"Sonny, take the next right. Head to the GW Parkway. Lot of quiet places there," he added ominously.
"You got it."
In a few minutes, they were on the George Washington, or GW, Parkway, heading north.
"Take the next turn off," Cove said.
They pulled into a sightseeing lot that provided a beautiful view of Georgetown and far below the Potomac River. A stone wall served as a buffer from the steep drop. Day had turned to dusk, and there were no other cars parked in the lot. Cove looked around, opened the door, and pulled T out with him.
"If you dudes arresting me, I want my lawyer."
Venables got out too and looked around. He eyed the drop, glanced back at Cove, and shrugged. Cove grabbed the smallish T around the waist and lifted him up.
"What the hell are you doing, man?"
Cove climbed over the stone wall and down on the other side while T struggled in vain. There was a narrow strip of ground and then a drop of about 100 feet into the river, which was filled with rocks. Down the river and on the opposite bank were a number of buildings housing local boating clubs. They were painted bright colors and their members rode the waters in canoes, sculls, kayaks, and other assorted watercraft that required muscle rather than combustion engines to make them move. There were several of them on the water right now, and T was given an inverted view of that picturesque scene because Cove was holding him upside down by the legs over the drop.
"Holy shit!"
screamed out the flailing T as he looked down to oblivion.
"Now we can do this the easy way or the hard way, and you're gonna have to decide real quick because I'm out of time and patience," said Cove.
Venable squatted on top of the wall and kept a lookout for other cars.
"Better listen to him, T. The man doesn't lie."
"But you guys are cops," wailed T. "You can't do this shit. It's fucking unconstitutional."
"I never said I was a cop," said Cove.
T stiffened and then glanced over at Venables.
"But damn it, he is."
"Hey, I'm not my brother's keeper," said Venables. "And I'm getting ready to retire anyway. I don't give a shit."
"Oxy," said Cove calmly. "I want to know who's buying it in D.C.
"Are you one crazy-ass mother or what?"
screamed T.
"Yes, I am."
Cove let his grip slip a bit, and T went down about 6 inches. Now Cove had hold of only the man's ankles.
"Oh, God. Oh, sweet Jesus, help me,"
whimpered T.
"Don't be talking to Jesus, T, not after the life you've led," answered Venables. "He might just send a lightning bolt, and I'm standing way too close."
"Talk to me," said Cove in his calm voice. "Oxy."
"I can't tell you nothing. Then folks come after my ass."
Cove let his grip slip again. Now he was holding on only to the man's feet.
"You wearing loafers, T," he said. "Loafers slip right off."
"Go to hell."
Cove let go of one of the feet and now was holding T by 1 foot with both hands. He looked back at Venables.
"Sonny, I think we better drop this one and go get us somebody else who's a little smarter."
"I got just the person. Let's go."
Cove started to let go of the foot.
No! Screamed T. I'll talk, I tell you.
Cove remained motionless.
No, I mean put me down and I'll tell you.
Sonny, go start the car while I throw this piece of crap in the Potomac.
No, I'll talk right here. I swear.
Oxy, prompted Cove again.
Oxy, repeated T, and he started talking fast, telling Cove all he needed to know.
Claire pulled her Volvo into her driveway and cut the engine. It was a nice neighborhood, not too far away from her office, and she had been fortunate enough to buy into it before housing prices soared. She made a good enough income, but the cost of living in Northern Virginia had become ridiculous. Builders were cramming places on any scrap of land they could find, and yet there were more than enough people willing to buy them. Her house was a three-bedroom Cape Cod with a nice patch of lawn in front, flowers in window boxes, a cedar shake roof, and a two-car garage attached to the house by a breezeway. The street was tree-lined, and the neighborhood contained a nice mixture of young and old, as well as professional and working-class people. After being divorced for so long, Claire was close to accepting that she would forever remain single. There were few eligible men in the social circles where she mingled, and none of them had captured her interest. She had girlfriends always on the lookout to fix her up with yet another tech mini-mogul or lawyer, but she found them to be so egotistical and self-centered that she figured marrying one of them wouldn't be all that different from remaining single. As a rebuke, she had asked one very self-involved high-tech chap at a party if he had ever heard of Narcissus. He had wanted to know if it was a new type of internet software, and then gone right on talking about how fabulous he was. She pulled her briefcase out of the car and headed up to the front steps. She hadn't pulled the car into the garage because she intended to go out again. The man coming out of her backyard startled Claire. He was black and large, with a head that appeared shaven, though he wore a cap. Claire focused on his gas company uniform and the electronic gas gauge he held in his hand. He passed her, smiled, and went across the street. She felt embarrassed for her automatic suspicion of a black man, though she had to admit, also with some embarrassment, that there were a few people of color in her neighborhood. Yet who could blame her for being paranoid after spending time with Webb London and men like him? She unlocked the door and went inside, her mind on her session with Webb. It had been shocking in many ways, but at least more revealing than shocking. She put her briefcase down and headed to her bedroom to change. It was still light out, and she thought she would take advantage of the nice weather and go for a walk. She remembered the pills in her pocket, pulled them out, and examined them. The unfamiliar one intrigued her greatly. She had a friend who worked in the pharmacy department at Fairfax Hospital. He could run it through some tests and tell her what this was. It didn't look like any sleep medication she had ever seen, but she could be mistaken. She also hoped she was mistaken about a drug interaction having made Webb freeze up in that alley. That might be something he could never recover from. As crazy as Webb's theory on voodoo was, she would take a curse over something Webb had inadvertently put into his body that caused his friends to die without him. No, the answer had to lie in his past. She was convinced of that. She sat on the bed and took off her shoes, went into her small walk-in closet, disrobed, and put on a t-shirt and shorts because the heat had returned. Barefoot, she came back out and looked at the phone. Maybe she should call Webb and talk to him. At some point, she had to tell him what she had learned about Stockton's death. The timing of it, though, was critical. Too early or too late a disclosure, and the consequences could be disastrous. She decided to take the chicken's way out and figure it out later. Maybe the walk would help her decide. She went over to her drawer and pulled out a baseball cap. She was about to put it on when a hand went around her mouth. She dropped the cap and instinctively began to struggle until she felt the gun barrel against her cheek, and she stopped, her eyes wide with fear, breaths suddenly coming in heaves. She remembered she hadn't locked the door on the way in. It was such a safe neighborhood, or at least it had been. Her racing mind wondered if the gas man was an imposter, and he had come back and was now about to rape her and then kill her.
"What do you want?"
she asked in a voice that was so muffled by the hand over her mouth that it didn't sound like her own. She could tell it was a man, though his hand was gloved because of the strength in it. The hand left her mouth and encircled her neck. The man didn't answer, and Claire saw the blindfold coming toward her, and the next moment she was in total darkness. She felt herself being led over to the bed, and she was terrified the rape was about to happen. Should she scream or fight? And yet the gun was still pressed to her right cheek. And the silence of her attacker was more unnerving than hearing his voice.
"Just be cool," the man said. "All we want is information. Nothing else from you."
His words seemed clear enough to her. Her body was safe. At least she could hope that. He guided her down so that she was sitting on the edge of the bed. She told herself that if he pushed her back and climbed on her, she would fight, gun or not. And yet she sensed him moving away from her. And at the same time, she sensed the entrance of another person. She tensed as this person sat next to her on the bed. A heavy man, she deduced, for the bed went down quite a bit with his weight. But he didn't touch her, though even through the blindfold she could feel his gaze upon her.
"You seeing Webb London?"
She jerked a bit at this question, for it hadn't occurred to her that this was about Webb, though she wondered why it hadn't. Her life was fairly ordinary, routine, no guns and men killed. That was Webb's life. Like it or not, she was now part of that life.
"What do you mean?" she managed to say.
She heard the man let out a grunt, one of annoyance, she thought.
"You're a psychiatrist and he's your patient, isn't that true?"
Claire wanted to say that ethically she couldn't reveal that information, but she felt certain that if she did, this man would kill her. As though he would care about her ethical constraints. To add credence to her belief, she heard what clearly sounded like the hammer of a gun being cocked. She had been around guns as a consulting forensic psychiatrist and knew that sound pretty well. A large cold mass formed in her stomach, and her limbs became rigid, and she wondered how Webb could deal with people like this every day of his life.
"I'm seeing him, yes."
"Now we getting somewhere. Did he mention a boy to you? A boy named Kevin?"
She nodded because her mouth had dried up so much she didn't think she could speak.
"He happened to know where that boy is now?"
Claire shook her head and tensed as he lightly squeezed her shoulder.
"Relax, lady. Ain't nobody gonna hurt you long as you cooperate. If you don't cooperate, then we have quite a problem," he added ominously.
Claire heard him snap his fingers, and about a minute passed in silence, and then she felt something touch her lips. She drew back.
"Water," the man said. "You got dry mouth. People scared shitless get that all the time. Drink."
The last word was an order, and Claire immediately obeyed it.
"Now talk. No more nods or shakes, you understand me?"
She started to nod and then caught herself.
Yes.
"What did he say about Kevin?" "Everything. I have to know it all."
Why?
She wasn't exactly sure where that bold question had come from.
"I got my reasons."
"Do you want to hurt the boy?"
"No," the man said quietly. "I just want him back nice and safe."
He sounded sincere, but then criminals often did, she reminded herself. Ted Bundy had been the king of smooth talkers while he methodically killed scores of women, smiling all the way.
"I have no reason to believe you, you know."
"Kevin, he my son."
She tensed at this and then relaxed. Could this be the big F person Webb had told her about? But he had said the man was Kevin's brother, not father. The man sounded like a concerned parent, yet there was something not quite right. Claire would just have to go with her professional gut on this one. What she sensed very clearly was that these men would kill her. Webb said he saw Kevin in the alley. He said Kevin said something to him and it affected him in a weird way. He saw him later while the guns were firing. He gave him a note and sent him off. He didn't see him after that. But he's been looking for him.
Is that all?
She nodded and then caught herself. She could feel him move closer, and even though she wore the blindfold, she closed her eyes. She could feel tears forming there.
Ground rules are no more nods or shakes. I need to hear words. Last time I'm telling you, you got me?
Yes.
She fought back the tears.
Now, did he say anything else about anything peculiar happening when he saw Kevin the second time?
She said no, but she had hesitated a second too long. She could clearly feel it, as though the pause had been a day long in duration. And she thought that he had noticed it as well. She was correct in that assumption, for she instantly felt the cold muzzle of a pistol against her cheek.
We having a serious misunderstanding here, like maybe I ain't making myself clear. Just so we are clear, let me lay this out for you, bitch. To get my boy back, I'll blow your brains out and everybody you ever cared about in your whole life. I see pictures all over the place of this cute-looking girl. Bet that's your daughter, ain't it?
Claire didn't answer, and she felt his hand wrap around her neck. His hand was gloved, which surprised her until she thought of fingerprints and DNA that machines could detect off of corpses. Her corpse. This thought made her feel faint.
Ain't it?
Yes.
He kept his hand on her neck.
See, you got you your little girl nice and safe. Perfect little house in a perfect little place. But see, I don't got me my boy, and he's all I have. Why you get your girl and I ain't get my boy? You think that's fair? Do you?
He squeezed her neck a little and Claire felt herself start to gag.
No.
No what?
No, I don't think that's fair,
she managed to say in a garbled voice.
Yeah, well, it's a little late for that, baby.
The next thing she felt was being pushed back on the bed. Her earlier promise to fight if they attempted to rape her seemed ridiculous now. She was so frightened she could barely breathe. She felt a pillow being placed over her face, and then something hard jammed into the center of the pillow. It took her a few seconds to realize that the hard object was the pistol, and the pillow would serve as a crude silencer. She thought of her daughter, Maggie, and she thought of how her body would be found. The tears streamed down her cheeks. And then, for one miraculous second, her wits came back to her.
He said that somebody had switched the kids in the alley.
The pillow did not move for some seconds, and Claire thought she had lost after all. Then it was slowly removed, and she was jerked up so hard she thought her arm had been dislocated.
Say again?
He said that Kevin had been switched in the alley for another boy. The boy who went to the police wasn't Kevin. He was taken in the alley before he got to the police.
Does he know why?
No, and he doesn't know who did it, only that it happened.
She felt the pistol against her cheek again. For some reason, it wasn't as frightening the second time around.
You lying, you ain't gonna like what I'm gonna do to you.
That's what he said.
She felt like she had betrayed Webb to save herself, and she wondered if he would have rather died than done such a thing. He probably would have. The tears started coming again, and not out of fear this time, but from her own weakness.
He thinks that Kevin being in that alley was planned by whoever was behind what happened. He thinks Kevin was somehow involved.
She quickly added,
but unwittingly. He's only a child. The pistol was removed from her cheek, and her interrogator's large presence also moved away.
That it?
That's all I know.
You tell anybody we hear, you know what I'll do to you. And I can find your daughter. We've been through your house. We know all there is to know about you and her. Do we understand each other?
Yes, she managed to get out.
I'm just doing this to get my son back, that's all. I ain't like busting in people's homes and roughing them up. That ain't my style, especially women. But what I got to do to get my boy back, I'll do.
She felt herself nodding at this and then stopped. She never heard them go, although her hearing could not have been any more acute. She waited a few minutes to make sure. Then she said, "Hello?" And then she said it again. She reached up slowly to undo the blindfold. She was waiting for hands to stop her, but none came. She finally pulled off the blindfold, and she quickly looked around the room, half expecting someone to leap out at her. She would have liked to collapse on the bed and cry for the rest of the day and night, but she couldn't stay here. They said they had been everywhere in her house. She threw some clothes in an overnight bag, grabbed her purse and a pair of tennis shoes, and went to the front door. She looked out, but saw no one. She quickly went to her car and got in. As she drove off, she kept her gaze on the rearview mirror to see if anyone was following her. She was no expert in that, but there didn't seem to be anyone there. Claire entered the Capitol Beltway and sped up, unsure of exactly where she would go.